All right, as we're starting tonight, we're in the 14th week. Tomorrow night will be the 14th week. And as we're dealing with it tonight, I might say that I am improving really so fast that, as I said last week, I'm afraid there's going to be a nosedive somewhere down along the line. And I feel like tonight we're going to have a class. I'm not going to cry for the first time, and we'll just be able to talk about it in a very pleasant way. In fact, as I was typing up my notes and so forth, I think that most of them probably pretty boring this week because not any real big things have actually happened. I would like to start our class tonight by asking you a question. And that is, how many of you have found it easier to talk to your mate about death? Hold up your hand, kind of give me an idea. Have you been doing it? Okay. I hope that you will, because, and I'm not asking you to go home every night and talk about death all night long. I realize that. I realize that's on my mind all the time. I know that. But it would not be a healthy situation if that's all that you thought of in your home life. But I would urge you to talk about death because it will help you. And it's just impossible for me to tell you how much it's meant to me for her to have told me what she did tell me before she died. And I can see now that if I didn't know her attitude, didn't know what she thought and so forth about certain things, that it would just have a big effect on me. And as I think about things that have helped me to recover, that is one of them. There are just a number of things. In fact, in my life, I can't think of any bad thing I've got as far as a recovery is concerned. It's just an ideal situation all the way through. And so I want to urge you to do that. No big conversations. You don't have to have long conversations, working out details and so forth, but to sit down and just talk seriously about certain things, and you just can't imagine how much it would mean. Now, I say that on the basis of having read a lot of other books and a lot of experiences of other people, and if they haven't talked about this, then it is a real grievous thing, and especially on the woman, it seems, that if she doesn't know the desires of her husband, it's very hard for her to cope with a lot of things. So I'd urge you to get busy and do that. Brian and Kelly, that should be the first thing you talk about is after your wedding there, is that. That may be carrying it just a little bit to the extreme. Now, as we're starting out tonight, as I said, the evaluation of it, that I feel that I'm much improved, and what I think I will do is tonight I'm going to just kind of read you the diary that I have written, which isn't going to take very long. Just kind of read it to you, and then we'll get on into the books that we're talking about. Because if I went over a lot of these things, I'd just be repeating a lot of things that I've already repeated. But now, as I'm doing this, really, what I've got down here is that my evaluation is I'm much improved. I'll just read my diary tonight and go on to the books. I feel like that I am about where most people talk about 6 months. I'm probably not, but I feel like it is the way I'm talking. In other words, as I read the stories of other people and what they're saying, where they are, what they're thinking, how they feel, and so forth, why I do feel that I, in the past 3 weeks, have made a tremendous change. It's just so much, as I say, that it really scares me. Now, what can you learn and watch for? Up to this time, I haven't been able to tell you what you could watch for. I just get up and tell you what's happened, and then you do it. But what I would say is this, a couple things that you might look for. And that is that in my reading and in all of this, it shows that in about the fourth or fifth month, that there is a fall into depression, of where you really have a crash, is what they say. And sometimes it is the worst part of it all. So I'll tell you, it appears to be normal. That's the way that people talk about it. So you can watch for it. I'm now in the fourth month. And it's starting out 4 months and one, or 3 months and 1 week. And so in the next couple of months, you may see a change in my attitude or in my disposition. It's just something to look for. My feeling is that I'm not going to do that. But who knows? I'm just living really one day at a time on that. Now, another thing, as I'm reading here what I'm going to be saying, notice the difference in my attitude between Saturday and the weekdays. As I was typing it up today, each day I just write down thoughts as they came to my mind, just whatever it was, things that seemed important to me at that time, and write it down, and then this afternoon I typed it up, and it's rather significant as you type it up, my attitude, how it changes from a Saturday to the normal days. Now you say, well, what do you learn out of that? Well, you learn, really, that keeping busy is a great help, but you can't keep busy 7 days a week. In other words, what I'm doing actually is I'm doing my job 6 days a week, and then on Saturday, why, I just take off, spend with the family, or do something, you see, of a different nature. A Saturday, again, is a tremendously hard day, because that's the day that I would look forward to of getting up. We'd go out to breakfast together, and we'd spend the day together, and go to garage sales, or whatever, you know, she'd like to do. All right, as we start out, what I put down here is last Friday. We went to Wenatchee and moved Kim, and I really enjoyed the trip over with the Hardys and visiting with them, and it was a very enjoyable thing. However, when I got back to Monroe, I had my car there, and Kim drove her car, and I drove my car, and Randy drove his, and so I was driving alone. And so I said I drove myself, and I realized at that time, there was a realization went over me from there down, that she was telling me in those last discussions that her body could go no farther. She was leaving me to finish the course alone without her. In other words, it hit, just kind of like that. She was giving me specific instructions that she was knew that her body could not go any farther, leaving me alone, and she wanted another wife to help me. She had done her job. She had finished her course. And my life and work was very important to her, and it should be finished with zeal and dignity. In those conversations, it's clear to me now that is what she was saying, that one of the reasons she said that she now would be a good time for her to die was because that if she would live to where her diabetes caused complications, that it would hold my work back. And she said, I don't want to do that. And so on Friday, I put down, I'm accepting it. At least I'm starting to accept it. And on Saturday, I write, I'm beginning to realize it is for real. It hurts. It hurts at odd times. Just driving down the road and I break down. She won't ever be back. I'm alone. Oh, how those words hurt. No one can replace her. I desire no one. I'm alone. I don't hurt as much as last Saturday. The pain is not as intense, but it feels like a heavy thug inside me. And then I got to thinking about her qualities, her quietness, her gentleness, love, companionship, those last words that she said to me. The thing that came to my mind was, is how loud can quiet be? Having her to sit around the house and she's quiet, but how loud that was, how still it is without her. How severe can gentle be? How sorrowful can love be? How lonely can companionship be? How enduring can a few quick words be? That is, how long can they last? Saturday night, I watched my first television program without reading. You say, what does that mean? Well, it just means that up to this time, any time I'd go home, turn on the television, well, that wasn't enough to keep my mind. I'd have to be reading something and watching that, but I was able to change there. Saturday, I looked at her first picture where I could see her whole body. I just looked at her at family pictures, at the head view. And my stomach got light. I had to put it up. I just couldn't believe it. Sunday, a few little odds and ends happened at the beginning of the day, little annoyances, and which really mean nothing to me. Little things that used to kind of irritate mean nothing. And then I wrote down, today I wish I knew why God keeps me alive so I could do it and go on and be with Him. Said, I'm thinking of how she talked of feeling good, but her body hurt. This is something she has done for years. As I would ask her, I'd say, how are you feeling today? She'd say, I'm feeling pretty well, pretty good today. And then the next statement she'd say, but she'd say, I've really got a pain in my side. And I said, I thought you said you were feeling good. Well, I am. It's just my body is hurting. And I looked at her, you know, and I said, well, if your body's hurting, you're not feeling good. Yes, I am. And so she said, can't you understand that you can feel good, but your body doesn't? And that there's a difference in that? And I'd say, no, if my body hurts, I don't feel good. If you ask me how I feel, I say I feel good. It means I'm not aching anywhere. I feel good. And that's another thing. She said, well, someday you'll learn. And I think I do know now. But I remember at this time, this Sunday, I was there. But then I remember reading. I remember reading this in the bathtub, this little book, and it's trying to pep you up and like that. And it said, life must go on. Life is for the living. And the way that hit me at that time, I remembered it then and comparing it to now, that my feeling was nonsense. I don't want to live. Therefore, I don't want life. I mean, why tell me life is for the living when that's the last thing I want to do? And the feeling I had is, you'd just as well tell me that vomit is for a connoisseur. That's my feelings. As to tell me that life is for the living. Go try that on somebody that's going out to dinner and see what it does for them. But now, at this time, I'm beginning now to see life. I'm alive and meant to be. I'm what God made me, and much of that is through her. And I'm starting to look at life through an entirely different set of eyes, is what I'm saying. Monday. Mondays are good days. Five more productive days before Saturday. I feel good. She has made a new life for herself without me, and now I must make a new life without her. There's a purpose for my life, and that purpose can only be fulfilled by living one day at a time and doing what God wants today. Dina goes for her exam tomorrow. I'll deal with that tomorrow, even though the results could be very, very bad and traumatic. I must remember Romans 8, 28. I might tell you a little bit about that because it is something that's happened. And that is that Dina has had to go in for her six-month check each 6 months since her operation 18 months ago. The last time they went in, and one part of the test showed that everything looked good, and the other part of the test showed that she had those cancerous cells still in there. And so they told her that at this time, she comes back in February, if they're there, then they would have to take her total lung, and it would be a major operation. And so for the past 6 months, at least, in fact, the past 18 months, but especially the past 6 months, why, you can imagine the feeling, you see, that's really been on our shoulders in thinking about that. Well, she went in day before yesterday. She went in Tuesday, wasn't it? She went in Tuesday. This is on Monday that I'm writing this. And as she went in, we were afraid, all of us, as we go back to Mason Hospital where she has this test done, that's where Doris died, that it'd be very hard on us. And I was thinking, you know, if it turns out bad, I don't know what I'll do without her. If it turns out good, I want to share it with her. And upset, you know, on what to do. Well, they did pull the test, went out and pulled the test and looked and came out and said it looks all clear, said everything just looks fine and don't see any problems in there. And as far as I'm concerned, it's not going to come back. If it hadn't come back now, why, it's not going to. Asked us to go up and see the head of the department to see what he had to say at 3 o'clock. So we had about an hour to do it. Have I got it down here? When I get down to Tuesday, I can tell just a little bit about that. I'll just hold it off then and tell you what happened there on Tuesday. On Monday, I'm beginning to feel like I'm not stressed in a time capsule. I don't have to do certain things before a certain time. I will heal, and it really doesn't matter if it takes 1 or 2 years. I must give it at least a year. But I feel like a shipwrecked man bobbing out on a life raft in the middle of the ocean. He knows he can't be rescued for at least a year. What will he do? Cry or fish? I'm going fishing, is what I put down, which is really my attitude. I mean, that was not my attitude a couple of months ago. You said, what are you going to do? I'm going to cry, see? But my attitude is changing in this, and I know that that's what she would want, and I know that's what I want, and I know it's what the Lord would want, and there's a purpose there, and so I made up my mind that's what I'm going to do there. Now, Tuesday. Dina goes to the hospital. And I've got some things written down, oh, how it hurts, and I pray, and I read, and I pray some more, and we should hear in about 15 minutes, and so forth, and then they brought in the good news. And as they brought in the good news, the first thing that came to my mind was, I wish Mom could hear this. But then immediately, I thought, well, there's no mourning in heaven where she is. She's not sorrowful. And enjoy it. Get ready to go out and celebrate, go out to dinner and enjoy it. And it really didn't hurt because she wasn't there to share that with us. Like, it has hurt so deeply on everything else. The tremendous pain was not there. Now, then Dean and I went in the other doctor's office, and while we were sitting in there waiting for the head man to come in to give his analysis, it was the first time that I was able to see her. I could see her sitting there in the chair. And I've been dreading that moment, afraid that I wouldn't like it, but it was nice. It was comforting. And since that time, I've been able to see her. I can see her right now in my mind's eye. And so it's been, a little over 3 months before I could really visualize what she looked like. And it came back on Tuesday. Wednesday, which was yesterday, I go down to Burger King for coffee, and the mountains were just beautiful. I put down here, they're so pretty, and I'm comparing all this week certain things. I couldn't help but thinking after she first died, I'd go down and sit there with a cup of coffee and look at those mountains and think how pretty they were, but I'd never be able to enjoy them again as long as I lived, But I am. I'm enjoying looking at them. And so by comparing these things, you can test your improvement. And as you see that you are improving, it gives you a good feeling. So I feel different, improved, changing fast. I even feel that it honors her if I do improve. This week I compare everything. As I drive home, I compare how I felt 2 months ago, and so forth. And I do that almost every night when I drive home. I think now, as you were driving home 2 months ago, that sickening, horrible feeling, wondering, will she be there? Will there be a light on? Is not there now. I think about her every time I'm driving home, but it's not that sickening feeling. Now I put down, I can't believe now how I felt when I cut my finger with that saw. It's totally beyond my comprehension of how I felt. In total abandonment, I could have cared less. It made no difference whether it was off or not, because there was just nobody who cared. There was nobody in the house, and no way I can believe that. And I put down, I'm not denying the bad things about it, but I am looking for the good in being single. I'm starting to do that. There's so many bad things, but there are good things too. Now, so far I haven't found a great number of them. But they're out there, and God willing, I'm going to find them. And I made up my mind to that. Thursday, that's today, is a good day. I'm still improving. I can feel that I am accepting it, and I can see her now at will. I like it, and so forth. Dina called in just a little while ago and gave news on the lab report. That's what really the other one we were waiting on, and said that it had come back, and it showed all clear. And so she has a clear bill of health now, and she asked him, could she go ahead and have children and so forth, and he said, well, he would put some restrictions on it, said shouldn't have, he thought, over 8 or 10. And so girls, get ready, I guess, for one more of those. Now then, so in other words, now what a relief. So it has been a good week. Another thing that we've been talking about from week to week are the children. Dina called today and said that she was feeling unattached, having no interest in anything, and so forth. And it's been coming on for about 3 weeks. And, of course, this is what happened to Kim. And we talked about it, and she was wondering, am I going crazy? Am I going into a depression that will last? And I don't know. I said, Dina, you're not. Even the books deal with it. They generally have a chapter in there entitled, I'm Going Crazy. And I made you a copy of one of those to give to you tonight to show that you're not going crazy. You do feel this way. And so we talk. I think what happens is this, that as the spouse, I lost everything I had. I know you say, well, you didn't, but as far as I'm concerned, I lost everything I had. And so I went in total depression immediately. The children lost half of what they had. In other words, they lost half of their parent. And so they purposely cover up poor parents. All children do this. They cover up to help me. And as they do that, they put off that terrible grief and acceptance a little bit later. And I'm sure that what has happened is that we've all come into the acceptance period really at the same time. It's been going on for about 3 weeks. And as in my case, it's making me feel better. I'm feeling better all the time. In their case, it's making them feel worse, see, because they haven't really worked through it the way I have. And there's a reason for it that I think that they've been holding it off and protecting me. And so I told her the only thing that I can tell you is that you're not going crazy. There's nothing I can tell you to keep you from doing this. Nothing I can tell you to keep the hurt away. You will feel this, but it will get better some of these days. And so they're going through that. Another thing we've been talking about is in remarriage, just to give you a thermometer of the feelings as you go along on that. On that, again, there's no change except I'm more set whatsoever. If I had to make up my mind right now and sign a contract, what I would do with the rest of my life, it would certainly be that I would never get married, is the way I feel right now. I'm more afraid of it than ever. In fact, I put down here, I've added two new qualifications. You remember, I had some pretty stringent ones to start with. You know, that she has to be a nice lady that is a Christian, and she has to be a widow, and she has to be very faithful and so forth. And so I decided she has to be cute and rich also. So from that, I think you can see I'm getting better. As far as humor is concerned, I really haven't done anything stupid this week, unless you count locking myself out of the house stupid, walking out and slamming the door without the keys. And some of you ladies, I suppose, can understand this. The ignorant men can't. I made the bed, you remember? I made the bed all by myself. And three times this week, that dumb bottom sheet, which is a fitted sheet, has come off the corner of my head and come back and scared me to death. It never did that when Doris was making it, so. But I'm learning. And the next time, next June, when I make that bed again, that corner is not going to come off. Okay, that's generally speaking, that nothing really big and fanciful as going on there. Do you have any questions before we go to the books and so forth, and trying to get through as much material as we can in that? Yeah, Art.
Lowell, you're over this period of time compiling a lot of sheets of notes.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any distant plans as to what you're going to do with those?
I don't know. I change every day on it. I think out of everything I've read, there's something that's missing, and that is looking at death through the eyes of the Bible, the Bible teaching. And I'm going to deal with that in this class as soon as we can get into it. And I might write something from that viewpoint, rather than writing it from a scientific viewpoint, you know, and saying this and this and this and this. There's enough on the market to show that this is what happens. But I might write with how to deal with these things through the eyes of inspiration. And I really feel that has helped me tremendously, dealing with it, you know, from the Bible viewpoint. In there, it just, I can't tell you really how much it has helped me. Just to illustrate, you asked that. I didn't even know whether to bring this up or not right here, but I'll do it right now. In Job, I'm going to deal with Job and in here just in real quickly, not tonight, but to see, and you will be able, I think, to see passages now that you haven't seen before. You know, I mean, I can, and I think that you will be able to, too. But one thing about Job, he had a lot of problems, didn't he? Now, I can't even conceive of an individual having all the problems Job has. Now, see, I've told you over and over and over again, if there was ever a man who lost his mate, who had any problems, that had it the easiest of anybody in the whole world, I really believe it's me. See, I believe that with all my heart. Everything has worked in my favor. Now, with Job, was that true? No, that wasn't true in Job's life. So, Job had it terribly. But let's remember one thing, and that is that when tragedies happen, that generally is not the only tragedy that you have. You know, just one thing. And to illustrate, I just wrote down here some things that have been on my mind, things I had to deal with here, in addition to Doris's death. And that is that Dina, living with this, might have to have that lung removed today. See, that she would be in the hospital. And so that has been a tremendous weight on my mind. Something that you don't know, and I asked Rhonda if it was okay to tell this now, and she said, well, yeah, if you want to. But they got married June 8th. And she was having some tremendous headaches. And so she went to the doctor, and this was about 3 weeks or a month before. And he examined her, and he says, well, there's a good chance you have a brain tumor. I said, that looks like that's probably, you know, what it is, a brain tumor. So she came home, and wow, you know, here it is. And he set up a test, said, we have to pull this particular test. And so they go down to pull the test, and couldn't get in for the test until about 2 weeks before the wedding. Now, you stop to think. You see, if she does have a brain tumor, they get married, there's not going to be any insurance, and $100,000 won't even start to cover this thing, see? And so there's just no way that they could possibly get married if this is the case. So wait around, and you say, well, that's their problem. Well, it's old Dad's problem, too. See, you know, I'm wrestling with this thing. What in the world, you know? And so they go then for the test, and the doctor says, okay, we'll pull the test, and we won't have the results, I think, until June the 19th, I believe it was. And the wedding is June the 8th, and all the invitations have been sent out, on this. And we ask him, why don't you talk with him, try to get it, can they possibly get the test back before? So they talk with the doctor, and the doctor said the quickest we could possibly do it, if we rush them in, put a rush on it, and I call you immediately when they come back in, would be June 7th. They're getting married June 8th. See? So, you know what we were all doing, sitting around waiting on that wedding, wondering whether it was going to be there. So on June 7th, I composed a letter to give to Don to have him to read in case the report came back that she had a brain tumor. No way to call everybody and call off the wedding. The only thing we could possibly do is, we're going to find out that night, the next day's a wedding, is to, when the crowd assembled, to get up and read a letter stating the tragedy that has happened. And so I prepared a sermon in case it was good. I prepared a letter in case it wasn't. And we're very fortunate that I was able to do the sermon. But it's a lot of pressure that you have on you. I've talked about financial losses, and we'll talk about that. I'm not asking for any sympathy. I'm not in any financial need, but I have lost some camels. If you look at it in Job's eyes, and quite a few of them. Jobs of my children and so forth have been quite a problem. But see, things now are turning around. Dina's lung turned out fine. Rhonda didn't. The test came back and said, oh, it showed up nothing. And the doctor just sounded like, you know, he didn't apologize. There wasn't anything wrong. Just, it turned out real good. And, of course, then Rhonda's sickness, when Mom died, you see, that very day, was running back and forth in there. And so there have been a lot of pressures, is what I'm saying. Just a tremendously lot of pressures. Other than just Doris's death. Now, does a study of Job help you? You see, in a case like this? And so what I'm saying is that you can see God's wisdom when he deals with this, and when he picks a man like Job, and when he shows all of this, he's got all of this pressure. What would I do if Job had not been in there, and So I have all these problems, and the only thing Job had was had a wife to die, you see. I would have said, well, no man's ever had the problems that I have. You know, I mean, it's just not known, and so I have a legitimate reason to roll over and give up. Job has become an appreciated man in my eyes. Now, anything else before we start on this other thing? What I'm going to try to do is go through a bunch of notes that other people have written as rapidly as I can. I want to go through another book with you, isolated parts of it, which I think is really the best book on the market. I want to deal with the Bible's viewpoint of a lot of these things, finding Bible answers to these problems of sorrow and suffering, then the finances and going to the mortuary and doing a lot of these things in a few weeks that we have to finish up. Okay, as we start out, now some of these things are going to be disconnected, but I'm going to try to give you as much information as I possibly can. In other words, I haven't taken paragraphs and cut them all out, and I just haven't been able to take the notes and do that, but I've made copies of these things, and we'll do it in this way. All right, as we start out, the first thing that is going to happen, as we've already talked about, is that denial. Now, here's a person who's been through it, and she says, the second we're notified of the presence of death, we cannot believe it, and all our emotions gather forces and shout, no. It's too incredible to comprehend, never seeing one here again. It's too unthinkable to imagine what the silence would be like, never to hear one's voice again. It's totally unimaginable to fathom living each day without that one. That's what the feeling is going to be like. And then she goes down and says, even though she's been through it a time or two, if you told me right now one of my children or my husband, you know, was dead, she said, I'll tell you exactly what I would do, and she just outlines it again. I would say, oh no, I would deny it, and goes on like that. One man illustrates that, you know, it's a denial. And said it just hit with a sting of dynamite when the doctor told him. Later, he described his denial symptoms as burning sensations in his chest, poundings in his head, numbness in his arms and legs and feet that had gone all rubbery under him. Instant denial hits not only verbally with oh no, but physically devastates us as well. And so that is something that certainly is going to happen. Well, I'm going to skip over some of these things right in here. It's talking about some of them I hate to skip over too. It talks about here, it said, we are seeing a few courageous men and women who are stepping forth to say, hey, let's not run and hide from this, and let's not morbidly take death to our arms as a lover, but let's learn what we can from dying and from each other in a death crisis. Now, this is coming up more and more, I'm glad to say. Then go ahead to explain, it's really not until you can accept death, not until you think about your death, not until you talk about your death, not until you express your death to somebody else, that you can really deal with life and start appreciating it. In bereavement, what happens when you start doing this? Well, here's just some facts and figures. Over 88% of the bereaved feel that expression rather than repression of feelings and crying should be encouraged at least sometimes. That is, 88% of the people said that you ought to encourage a bereaved person to cry and express themselves. And I certainly agree with that. Almost half feel that repression of distressing memories should rarely or never be encouraged. Don't ever encourage anybody. Now, don't talk about this. Don't bring this up. You know, try to be happy. Don't do that because you're going to cause some mental problems if you do. 87% agree that the bereaved should be encouraged to talk to old friends at least sometimes. 92% encourage talking with someone who's had a similar experience like this. So it gives you an idea that the vast majority of people agree that in doing this, that you need to deal with it really the same way. Express yourself. One statement out of this whole thing is that you, of course, the first thing, why indeed? Part of the answer lies in the unnerving fact that no matter how well prepared we are to face death and dying, it always catches us at the worst possible moment. That's something that I think will help, that there is no time in which you are prepared to lose a loved one. Even if the loved one has been in the hospital for 3 years dying of some dreaded disease, it catches you really in that moment, the least possible time. As we continue on, it says, bereavement is a universal experience, but only recently have we begun to study and to understand it better. There are many estimates to the extent of the problem. The average age of widows at the time of their husband's death is 56. About one out of every five children in the United States will lose one parent to death before the child is 16. 18% of Canadian women over the age of 14 are widowed. One-fifth of all new widows created each year are under the age of 45. Three-quarters of the women who become widows at 45 can expect to live at least 25 years longer. Just here's some facts that you look at that need to say, well, we need to look at it and we need to consider this. Most of the books have been written from a widow's viewpoint. And obviously there's a reason for that, and that is that women live longer than men, and there are some places four widows to every one widower, and other times in other age groups eight widows to every widower. And when you get to looking at that, you can see that the poor widow really is going to have a tremendous time, not only in grief and trying to handle the problems, but in being left alone. There are just more of them than there are widowers. It says, after the first phase of numbness and spiritual concussion comes the second phase with the typical pangs of grief and intense feeling of yearning and pining for the person we've lost, with anxiety, fear, and bewilderment. We recognize intellectually that it's no use walking the streets and calling and searching for them, but there is a gut-level urge to do so. One mourns the irretrievable loss of the familiar. In other words, that's the thing that you want to do. There's no way really to get out of it. Another thing, we'll not talk about this much right here. We're going to get back on this bereavement in here. But it says there's relatively little guidance available at present concerning how society expects bereaved people to behave. That's significant in this respect. You wonder, all of a sudden, what is expected of you. See, what does society expect you to do? How should you act to keep people from saying that you're disrespectful, that you're not showing the proper respect you should have? Now, we're in a free society today. We're in a death-denying society. Now, back when I was a boy, when a man died, a widow was expected to wear black and stay home for a year. And if she went to a party within a year, why, she was looked upon as a rather loose woman, that she was expected to mourn her husband for at least a year. Now you say, well, that's bad. Well, it may be bad, but it's also good. It's good in the sense that she knew what she was supposed to do. Now here's a problem. Today, when all of a sudden you're left, you don't have the slightest idea what you're supposed to do. See? You don't have the slightest idea. Because our society has no custom, no expectations of what you do. And so you're just kind of left on your own and wondering, am I making a fool of myself? What should I do? When should I go certain places? When should I do certain things? Now, maybe it's the difference between a man and a woman. I'm sure it is. I really haven't had any problems with that. Determined to start with that I was going to do what I thought I ought to do, and I've done that all the way along, and I think that it's helped tremendously. Now there was a time though of when it hit pretty hard, and so I understand, and I think that a widow would have this to hit probably every day of her life. What am I expected to do? What should I do? And that is when I took my wedding ring off. One of the terrible things that hit you hate to take it off. And then the other thing is, what will people think of you if you take it off? And my fears were, if I take it off, everybody's going to get the idea that I'm about to get married. I've got some woman in mind, and old Lowell is getting ready to court, see? That was my fears. I didn't want to leave that impression. I didn't want people to think, here it is, she's been dead 8 weeks, and he's already got somebody picked out. He's already getting prepared, you see, to get married, because that is not the case. As I said, I was playing with my ring. Every day it was there. I was twisting it. I was taking it off. I was putting it back on. And it was just a constant reminder that it does not belong on that finger. But it does belong on that finger. It's been on there for 32 years. The groove is still in there. But you're living a lie. If you go out somewhere and somebody sees that ring on there, they'll think you're married and you're not married. Well, who cares? I mean, what they think. I have been married. I feel as married now as I ever did. And you wrestle with it. And it's ambivalent. And you go back and forth. Now, what I had to do, really, was two things in fighting that battle. And that is to determine to myself, when are you going to do this thing that's going to hurt so much? You know, it's like cutting your wrist. You know, if you're getting ready to draw blood, when will I slice? You have to think about it for a while because it hurts. Then, when you think, what will other people think about it? You see, it hurts. Now, if we had a custom that you're supposed to wear your wedding ring for 8 weeks or a year, you know, it wouldn't make any difference. Then you wear it, you take it off, and part of those problems have been answered. Well, all I'm saying is we're living in a death-denying society, and that gives a lot of problems, really, to a lot of people. A little statement here that is really off course, but I check because I like it. It's talking about what you can learn from situations like this, and it says, an opportunity is often very little more than a misfortune looked at from a different angle. That's a pretty rich thought right there. An opportunity is often a little more than a misfortune looked at from a different angle. Now, you can have a misfortune come in your life, and you can look at it from one angle, and that is that my wife is gone. She's gone forever. My heart aches, and I can talk for hours and hours about the pain, or I can turn it around and look at this misfortune from another angle and see how that I've learned so much, how I will make a better man out of me, and start looking, you see, at this. And said what you actually do is you come into this. You say, I cannot go on living without him. Having spent perhaps many years living together, it's very hard to envision how you could live without the dead person. So you will find a way. He said, but you will find a way. So often one attempts to face the whole future at once. How can I face 20 years without him? That's the way you feel. But you will not live that period all at once, only day by day. Don't try to face 20 years alone. Face today. I talked about that. In this, I have learned that. Now, I haven't learned it so good that I will practice it all the rest of my life. I know that. When happiness comes back in my life and so forth, I will regress right back into the old situation of looking at 20 and 30 years, ahead. But that's what hit me. How can I live for another 20 or 30 years? It's just totally impossible to even comprehend doing all of that for another 20 or 30 years. And so I've learned during this period of time to just live one day at a time. And there have been many of you who have invited me out to dinner, can you come over Friday night? And I've told you I don't know. Man, it's only Wednesday, and that's 48 hours. And call me tomorrow and I can tell you. See, or ask me Friday morning and I can tell you. And it has really helped in doing it that way. It was not a cantankerous mood. Now, I'm up to 48 hours now. I can look ahead, you see, like that. But it wasn't being cantankerous. It's just that I had no idea what tomorrow held. And in dealing with Dina's situation, it helped me. I mean, thinking about it, I just said, if that happens, it happens tomorrow. And I went on about my business and didn't let it worry me that day. I thought about it quite a few times. I mean, it would come in, it put it out, but it wasn't a constant worry. A guy down here, loss is always difficult to accept, and it takes a while for our bodily and emotional systems to adjust to it. People who have had a limb amputated often continue to feel the limb that isn't there anymore for quite a time. Similarly, when a person has been amputated from life, there will be a finite period of time before you can function fully without that person. And that's true. You just can't function without them. These are feelings that you're going to have. Another thing, I haven't had this, but I'll put it out because a lot of people do, that in bereavement, that you have a lot of odd experiences, it says, of which you may hesitate to tell anyone about for fear of being thought peculiar. You may experience hallucinations. You may hear the voice of the person who's dead, often merely calling your name, especially in the part of the house you associate with him, or you may see him for a time quite clearly before you realize that this cannot be so and the image fades. A man of 82 years old told me about how this affected him after his wife's death. I go into the kitchen, he said, and there she is, sitting at the kitchen table, like she always was when I got home. I stand there and look at her, and then I remember that she's dead, and it sort of fades away. I was scared to tell my daughter in case she thought I was mad, but it's a comfort to me, and I'm glad she comes to me. It goes on then telling about some other situations like this. Now, this, I guess, is quite often that you do it. They say that they just actually see the person like that, and it hasn't happened to me. The closest thing that's happened is that there would be a... not every night, but many nights she would have to get up about 3 to 5 o'clock in the morning and get something to eat because of reaction insulin imbalance. And I would usually hear her rummaging around the kitchen, just be a little tick or something of this nature. She'd get up real quiet. And so when I'm sleeping or when I kind of wake up and I hear the refrigerator go on or something of this nature, my heart beats and I think she's in there, and then it catches me she's not. But it's not an hallucination. It's just a sound that brings your memory to things like that. Again, as I'm reading this is from a widow's viewpoint, but it works either way. It tells here about how you can get upset at certain things. Just catching sight of a crowd of someone who looks like her or dressed as she used to be, or glimpsing a car like the one he used to drive. Now, this happened to me a couple of times. Right after the first couple of weeks, we were at a place and there was a piece of plywood up there, and here goes a gray-haired woman with her hair put up, and I looked over and there it went by that, and my heart just jumped, as though it was her. I met one of the kids down here at Burger King, and they drove the Mercury in, and when I drive up, there's the Mercury, and my heart just jumps. There is Doris, you see, and just pangs. You things hit you like that. Well, she tells here, having to cope for the first time with a blocked drain, sewing on your first button or darning your first sock, deciding what to do with her shoes or his favorite pipe, catching yourself recalling that you've just finished the last jar of marmalade she made for you. You're going to find this is something that when you're finishing up the last thing that they ever did for you, changing furniture or something like that, you can see how it affects me right now of doing that. Throwing away a piece of clothing that she bought for you that's wore out or something of this nature, terribly hard. His fishing magazine arriving because you forgot to cancel the subscription. Tiny, trivial things, yet each one can suddenly pitch you back into despondency and grief, so you feel you're right back at square one and fear that you'll never get over it. But you will. It often feels as if you won't, as if all those friends who say things like, time is a great healer, are just making empty promises and quoting trite proverbs. It's as if the rules about how people do discover their great losses and so forth, live. Okay, here's one in the entitled Good Grief. And it's a catchy title, but what it means is some grief is good and some grief is bad. Now, what is the good grief? In good grieving, the aim is not the obliteration of memories of the one you've lost. On the contrary, he or she will be tenderly remembered, but without enslaving the living to those memories to the extent that they are prevented from developing further relationships. The widow does not need to forget her husband, but the time comes when she can spend days, even weeks, without thinking of him, and when she does, it can be with pleasure and not with pain. One does not stop caring for the dead, but one distills what was essentially important in the relationship and reinterprets it so as to meet a new future. You give up the person without giving up what he or she meant to you. Of course, this is so far beyond me right now that I have to take that by what they say. But I'm sure that it will be that way. Another statement here on grief, as people are trying to describe it. I'm just reading you out of different books the way people describe it. A person says, whenever I see someone newly grieving, I am impressed again how unbelievable is the first fresh test of sorrow. Grief is so afflicting that some experts, watching with a clinical eye, have compared it to a disease. For grief does have physical symptoms: exhaustion, dizziness, lack of appetite, occasional hallucinations, forgetfulness. Time does its healing job so well, I have almost forgotten what it was to wander, lonely as a cloud, escaping to my bed as though to a womb, trying to fill emptiness. Work, travel, a hectic pursuit of activities may close the pain temporarily, but they do not heal. In other words, here's a person who has healed up and said it's just unbelievable every time she sees them because she remembers what it was really like. Another bit of advice is you can't replace a dead spouse, nor can you expect to go on living exactly as you did when he or she was alive. So whether you remarry or build yourself a new and complete life alone, you must break with the past. I think we can all see that that is good advice. It doesn't make any difference what you do. Your past is not. You just can't live it now. Another man put it more bluntly. He says, a grieving survivor finds his world destroyed by the loss of a loved one. His task is to complete the destruction. He has to kill what little remains of his world and to kill himself as well. Now, if I were to tell you what grieving is like, I think that's what I would put right there. That is what it is. That when you're told your loved one is gone, it's just like somebody comes up and chops you up with an axe, but you're still alive. Now, your job is to continue the chopping and killing until there's nothing left. It is stated that until you have grieved each point to the maximum, you're not going to be able to get in to the next. Now, you say, I don't understand that. Well, I don't know how to explain it other than whatever is left, you have to go over it and over it and over it again and give up and give up and tell yourself, I'm alone, I'm alone, I'm alone, she'll never be back, and it hurts and it hurts, and you tell yourself more and it hurts, and you keep going over it and over it and over it until it can't hurt anymore. And when it gets to the point it can't hurt anymore, you suddenly start getting better and you go into a different phase. It's about the... That's what he means, and that's just about the way that it hits you. Now, he says, perhaps one early training in survival, the ability to be happy in disposition, to be grateful for happiness, helps one to keep healthy and endure and to get over these things. I think that he's right, and what we're trying to do now is just to have some early training before it ever happens so that we'll understand really what is going on there. Another one says then, getting too many mixed up here. She says, after my husband died, I felt like one of those spiral shells washed up on the beach. Poke a straw through the twisting tunnel, around and around, there's nothing left. No flesh, no life. Whatever lived there is dried up and gone. Perfect illustration. You remember I used a peanut? Just the peanut shell. Her illustration is better. I just read this the other night. You go out and you get a shell and you poke in there and there's nothing in there. That's what you feel like. That nothing there, but you're still here. You're still living. And you want to know why. I mean, why? If the shell is there. All right, it says a psychologist says this: I know of only one functional psychiatric disorder whose cause is known, whose features are distinctive, and whose course is usually predictable, and that is grief and the reaction to loss. He said, I've only found one thing that you can write down. This is how people will react. Okay? And he says, that is in grief. And he says, and yet this disorder, he complains, is not even touched on in most of the best-known general books on psychiatry. A fellow says, if only someone whom I respected had set me down after Martin died and said, now Lynn, bereavement is a wound. It's like being very, very badly hurt, but you're healthy. You're strong. You'll recover, but recovery will be slow. You will grieve, and that is painful, and your grief will have many stages, but all of them will be healing. Little by little, you'll be a whole person again, and you'll be a stronger person. Just as a broken bone knits and becomes stronger than before, so will you. Now, if someone had said that, what would have happened? Knowing me, I suspect that I would have protested. Oh, that's very interesting, but I'm sure you're right, but it doesn't apply to me. My case is different. You see, I... And then just blanks out there. And said, and I would have gone on to explain that mine was a very special case indeed. Now this is true. You say, well, should you explain that to a person? Tell them it's like a physical wound, which it is. It is just like a physical wound. You go out, get your leg broke, and you get cut up, lacerated. What you do is put a cast on it, lay around till you're healed, and then get up and go. Some of these days you'll be new again. You may walk with a limp, but you'll be healed up. So it is with this. Does that help? The answer to that is yes, if it comes from the right person. That's the key. If you're talking to somebody who respects you, if they respect you, and you know that they respect you as one that can give advice, and they believe that your advice is sound, you can give that to them and it will help. I was just dying for somebody to tell me that. See, I was just wanting them to tell me that. I would seek that out. I would ask people who've been through it. And I was hoping that that's what they would tell me. It seemed to be like that's the way it ought to be. But I could not comprehend it. I hurt so bad I would never heal. See? And so I was wanting somebody to tell me, Lowell, I hurt that bad. And you will heal. And I knew exactly what this person says. If they had told me that, I'd have said the same thing. Well, you did, but you didn't love your wife like I love mine. I mean, after all, there was no other Lowell-Doris relationship in the world. We love more and better and longer and more intense than any other couple that's ever lived. Romeo and Juliet never, you know. Well, that's how you feel. Now, you come up intellectually and say, Lowell, do you believe that? No. There's so many good love affairs going on in the world, and people our age that experience the same thing we're experiencing. I know all of that, but I'm just telling you how you feel, see? And it's much easier for me to say it now than it was if you'd have come up to me 3 weeks ago and said it. I would have listened to you and then let you go ignorantly on your way. It says, there is a pattern. Grief is predictable. Studies in this country and in England have corroborated that there are phases of grief and that phases follow phase as spring follows winter. And all of them show that you're going to go through that. Let me read something. Might be a little shocking, but really it's not. In one study of widows, the researchers were startled when woman after woman reported that the least helpful person had been whom? The least helpful person is whom? The preacher. That's right. Her religious leader. There's not a group of people more ignorant on the face of this world in what they're doing with death than the guy you're looking at. Than preachers. I can say that from my own experience in dealing with preachers. They do not understand the first thing about it, and the difference is you come to this class to try to learn because you say, I don't understand, and they, because they are a preacher, I think try to put on a front and say, well, I'm supposed to deal with this, and I do understand. And that's the thing that irritates me, is that if we can't learn, we need to learn. And so for every preacher out there that's listening to this tape, you understand my feelings very clearly. And there'll be no apologies. We need to learn from this. Okay. Another statement here from a new book. Most widows, 64% of our sample, reacted to the death of their husband with disbelief, shock, or both. It could not be so, or they could not feel it.
They were cold without emotion. Shock and disbelief were especially prominent where there had been no forewarning. 92% of the widows cried, some collapsed in tears, 88% became sad and despairing, sometimes shock and disbelief alternated with anguish sobbing. Psychophysical symptoms began for some. These included sleeplessness, 40%, loss of appetite, 36%. Some became unable to organize their thoughts and energies, and responding to this began to fear breakdown and collapse. 44% reported some loss of self-control. In the early weeks of bereavement, shock, physical distress, bewilderment, deep despair dominated the picture. They tried to be realistic to cope with their difficulties as they presented themselves. Indeed, if there was a single principle governing the behavior of our respondents, it was to carry on. They made strenuous efforts to exhibit the expression of their grief. They made strenuous efforts to exhibit the expression of their grief when strangers. There's something wrong there. What they're saying is that they made strenuous efforts not to exhibit their grief when they were around strangers. Try and try and try like this, but sometimes you can't help. An interesting thing to me happened. Doris and I would sometimes 10 o'clock of the night say, let's go up to Sherry's in Woodinville, run up there, you know, and share a piece of boysenberry pie. And so we knew the waitresses up there, not by name or anything, but here the other night, while Kim and the kids and I went up there, and so this older waitress came back, she's probably 65, and very happy and congenial, you know, and always has been, and always teased with us and all this, and comes back, and so she looks at me, and I'm sitting there with Candace, and, you got you a new girlfriend tonight, don't you? I'm not going to tell on you, I found me a new one here tonight, and it's obvious, you know, I've had Candace, but over there sat Kim and Kyle, and so she comes back around a little while, and she brings it up again, you know, said something about, you got your new girlfriend here, and then the third time she came around, and she said it again, So going out, well, I told her, I walked out and I said, the reason I don't have my wife here is because, you know, she died suddenly. And, of course, then it put her in shock. And then I feel bad about putting her in shock. But there are times of when you do bring it up to strangers because it has to be brought up when it's carried on just a little bit too long, see. But you do try your best around strangers not to to bring it up. A couple of days ago, when Dina... we celebrated her victory and so forth and went down to the bargain basement, and Kim was going up to the checkout stand, and this one person says, doesn't your mother usually come in here with you? So I see you and your mother, you know, in here, and I haven't been out here for 6 months, been back in there, you know, like this. Is she here today, you know, missing her? So Kim had to tell her no, and of course then she, oh my, you know, and so you don't like the reaction, but you do find these things. But you try your very best not to do it. I said not quite half said they felt free to express their feelings with at least one other person. Now, I want you to think about that, because that is bad. That is bad, 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 bad. That is like Americans getting sick, deathly sick, and never going to a doctor or telling anything about how they are. How many people feel free to talk to other people? Not quite half said they felt free to express their feelings with at least one other person. Now, I'm telling you, you're going to go crazy if you don't talk about it and express your to one other person. All right, shock and disbelief. The initial reaction of the majority of wives to news of their husband's death was, as we have said, a form of shock. They felt cold, numb, dazed, empty, confused. At the edge of consciousness for many was a fear of being overwhelmed, of being submerged, drowned by grief. Yet at the same time, the death might seem unreal and incomprehensible. It could not be grasped, but it could be felt. Frequently they said that when they were told that their husband was no longer alive, they were surprised to notice that they were devoid of any feeling. Later, they usually felt that numbness at that moment had been a blessing, preferably to the pain that they were not sure that they were ready to bear. The numbness constituted a brief moratorium from feeling, a time when they might know as a kind of external fact that their husband had died. but they would not have to deal with that knowledge emotionally. Well, that's what shock does to you. It keeps you from having to deal with it, you see, at this time. God built it in you, and it's one of the most amazing, wonderful things that ever happened. And again, in case I don't get around to it, when you see a person go into shock, as those of you came over to the hospital and saw me, your heart would just bleed because of Deb, I think the other day, was saying when she looked in that room and saw me sitting there, and I just sitting there like a zombie and staring, and I was white and gaunt, and she said it just scared her to death. Now, at that time, believe it or not, I wasn't hurting nearly as bad as I was hurting 3 weeks later. I mean, there wasn't even any comparison. And you say, why? I was just totally numb. I was hurting so much I could hurt, but then there was numbness there, and I can't explain it. You know, if you'd asked me, Lowell, can you hurt any more than you're hurting tonight when you were over at the hospital, I'd have said no. No way I could hurt more than what I'm hurting tonight. But please believe me, there's no comparison. And this is where we miss the point a lot of times. We surround a person the day of the death until after the funeral. And then a person gets up, they smile, they say, okay, you know, I've got to make a life for myself. And then we go back to our life and leave them then. And it's the next few weeks, which is the painful weeks. That's when you really need a friend. That's when you need to call people and say, what can I do for you? Let's go for a drive. Just be around. Let them talk. It's very essential to do that. All right, this organization... well, it says, shows here that they were aware of changes in themselves, of angry feelings. They knew to be unjustified, a susceptibility to despair, and to bewildering thoughts of self-destruction. The result was that even when the widow was, in fact, able to control her behavior, she might experience a frightening feeling that something is happening to me. Perhaps that I might do something I'll regret. Remember, what was one of the first things I said over to... Any people remember one of the first things I was worried about that night? Was saying, you know, I have a tremendous fear that I will do something totally foolish. You know, that'll just bring dishonor upon my name and upon Doris's name. There is that fear. You say, what caused it? I don't know what caused it. You don't have it 1 second, and the very next second it's there. It's in that shock. It said flirtations with self-destruction were not unusual. 3 weeks after their husband's death, 20% of our sample said they would welcome death if it were not for their children. Another 6% said they would simply welcome death without qualification. That's what I would have said. None of the women in our sampling, the thing I wanted most, the thing I wanted least, tell me, said, no, I'm not crazy. And it's helped a lot. 38% admitted to some fear that they might have nervous breakdown. Then they were in declined some social phase of mourning and so forth. The fears tend to reappear sometimes in more severe ways when the widows were left alone and began settling in their new life. Some widows realized that they were not able to perform routine tasks that they had previously been part of their everyday pattern or make any decisions of any sort. And they realized that this was just an impossibility for them to do. I just thought it says, but about 2 months later, when Christian friends have gone back to their work and have stopped praying, our world falls apart. That's when things really start falling apart. And they get on down, they say, about then, some wise enough to know better but doesn't, Christian, is shocked by a widow's action and question. Why, what happened to Mrs. So-and-so? She took her husband's death and stride at the funeral, and now look at her. I wish she'd snap out of this and be normal again. Too bad, though. I thought she was such a strong Christian. What's happened to her faith? In other words, boy, you know, everything just fine, and snap out of it. And don't understand, it's not a lack of faith. It is a tremendous hurt. What do you do if somebody laid you down on an operating table and took your gallbladder out without any anesthesia? I mean, would you cry? Would you yell? Would you wonder what's going on? Is it a lack of faith? See, that's the situation that you're in. So be careful when you're doing this. And it's the person that doesn't show this that later on then is going to have some terrible troubles. said, often we mistake the numbing effects of shock for strife. We think because the widow is taking the funeral in her stride, she's fine. Shock is the body's physical denial and protection that God allows us to be gently covered by it until the moment surrounding death. Okay, is denial all bad? I certainly thought so. I was one for facing the truth no matter how painful. Somewhere along the line, maybe after years of trying to hold back or stop my tears, I felt that denial was a weak or stupid trait. I wish I'd known it's a terribly normal emotion that desperately needs to be voiced. And if you don't learn anything else other than that in this class, that's going to help you tremendously. Now, denial is something. I'll tell you again, when they came in and told about Dina, you know, that everything is fine. I wanted to scream, but I didn't. I tried. This is great. But to really be elated, I wasn't. I was denying it. It's too good to be true. Just like Doris's death, when they said she's dead, it's too bad to be true. It's a denial. This was too good to receive. For 18 months, this weight has been on my shoulders and a tremendous, and just all of a sudden to take it off and it's not there anymore. Well, it's not there right now, but maybe in 5 minutes when we go up to the next doctor, it will be, see. And so I asked Dina later. I said, Dina, are you just terribly happy? I mean, how's this affected you? You really... And she said, no. Do you believe this? Well, yeah, I believe it, but I don't, you know. And neither one of us was accepting it. Denial is something that keeps you from really accepting things that are too good to be true, too. Okay, it goes on, says this is the exact moment that being a Christian really counts. We are not removed from denial just because we're God's children, but we should know and recognize denial for what it is. We should use denial as it is intended, as a buffer zone, and then move into acceptance. We must not live in denial. Anyone who tries to escape the realities of life and death will not be able to handle the ways of death and dying. We are to move out of denial toward acceptance. It will not be easy. It will not be without its cost and complications. But if we look closely, we see it's a very old problem. It has to be done. Now, right there's the stage you see I'm in, right there. I have some fears of moving out, but those fears are lessening every day. And as of today, well, in the morning when I get up, I'm changing so fast. In the morning when I get up, I'll be ready to do that. It's kind of the way I feel. Of saying, okay, I'm going to look at this as an exciting thing. See, I'm out on an exciting new part of life. Something I thought that I could never say, but I'm saying it. I don't believe it. I just lied to you. But tomorrow I'm going to do it. A doctor specializing in leukemia found in children, gave the chilling statistic that 70% of parents obtain a divorce once leukemia has been diagnosed in their child. Just think about that. Now, the reason for all of this is that they are not able to accept what really happens. This is where anger really comes in. And mates get angry one with the other. And you will make up every reason in the world to hold yourself guilty and to become angry, you see, at certain things. Or wife that says, honey, would you like to have tacos tonight? Yeah, well, could you run down to the store? You know, it's half a mile down there. I don't have any taco shells. So he runs down there, and a little while the police come back and say, your husband got killed in an automobile accident. She has a terrible time living with that. She murdered her husband. And she holds herself guilty. If I hadn't have thought of those stupid tacos, if I hadn't insisted he gone down, if I had gone down myself and let him read the paper, you know, I would have driven slower than what he does, and that other car would have been through. If it was just 1 second slower, there wouldn't have been an accident. And she holds herself guilty. And on and on and on, people do that. Now, in that again, I've never had that feeling. That's a beautiful thing. I've never had to really deal with that. The capacity to cry when we hurt and to cry with others when they hurt says it right where it's at. It said, we worry about what we will say to the bereaved. This is on another one down here. He changed it on. We worry what we will say to the bereaved when a hand clasp, a quick hug, or a small touch on the shoulder says it all mutely but magnificently best. Now, we're going to talk perhaps next week in things that you do. How do you handle this? Right here really is telling it. Everybody worries what you will say. See, what can I say? There's nothing you can say. See, nothing that you can say. The person knows there's nothing you can say other than to express your deep hurt. And you remember me talking about the hugs, the physical contact, which is just unbelievable in the way that it makes you feel. That's what they're saying. That says it all. Go ahead and say whatever you want to say. Just those of you who came up and just hugged me, that's what counted. What you said was not much, because I knew that you didn't understand. See, you said, I'm sorry. I knew you were sorry, but I knew you weren't sorry enough. See, in other words, there's no way you could understand, you see, the pain and the anguish that I was going through. Whatever you would say wouldn't really make sense, you know. If anybody came up with the old cliche, you know, I know how you feel. Boy, that's an insult. See? But what I'm saying is, everybody understands. There's really nothing, no words you can put in there other than being there, hug, and just stating, "I'm so sorry. I just can't believe it. I just feel so badly." Something of this nature. All right, another thing that they say. If we rush this time of adjusting along too fast, we rob grief of the work of the gradual healing it must carry out. We must not be in such a hurry to get ourselves or our bereaved friends back to normal. It is essential to remember normal has been forever altered into abnormal. We do the bereaved an injustice when we do not allow them to grieve, and since we need to grieve, if we're not allowed to, we create yet another problem, and that's guilt. And that is a tremendous problem that a lot of people explain. So, what do? They must be encouraged to talk. Here's what you do. Express their feelings, whether they're sad, angry, or lonely, and take all the time they need. The natural slowness of grief cooperates here and can be a useful tool toward adjustments in living. When I experienced my losses, I desperately wanted to talk with somebody about death and dying. Instead, I was given some rather sticky, sweet, pie-in-the-sky, by-and-by books that depressed me even more than I already was. What I needed at that point was not books, but people. And it's a pretty good statement, you see. Not just sweet little cliches. What I needed to know was that grief and sadness would be with me for a while. It would have helped had I known that the slowness of grief and the passing of time would give me the perfect opportunity to express my sorrow and begin healing. Eventually, I'd emotionally heal and see the lovely hope of God. But at that point in my grieving, to hear or read, "Buck up, life isn't quite that bad," was a frustration quite beyond comprehension. For somebody to tell you that. One person did in my own family. And I remember he's trying to do me a favor, but it wasn't in favor. Here's another thing. If I don't get this as a time to go along, what can you do? What can you do for the bereaved? Okay? This person right here says, during that period of time, my friends did come to the rescue. They understood somehow about my apathy, and they didn't ask about helping. They just did it. There was this college girl, Andrea, home for Christmas, who said, "When you want the children out of the house for a while, I'll pick them up." Or the other college girl who said, "It's the day before Christmas and I'm free. Which do you want me to do, dusting or ironing?" She ironed. Or Eleanor, who called and said, "I'm fixing dinner for your family one night this week. Which night would be best?" Now, what they're saying is how you can do this. Now, let me put it this way. Don't ever ask a bereaved person, or don't ever go up and say, "If there's anything I can do, call me." Now, I've told people that, and I know what I mean, I know what you mean. And that is, I hope you don't call me. You know, I mean, I'm so busy that like this, but I will come if you call. Now, you've been told that before. If there's anything I can do for you, call me. If you ever want to come over some night, how many times have you dropped by and you said, "You know, we got an invitation over to so-and-so's house"? I remember 6 months ago, Roy Rain says, "Stop by sometime. Let's just stop in." You don't do that. See? And a bereaved person is not going to ask you for help if that is the way that's left. So what's the saying is, I'm going to fix dinner for you one night. Which night would be best for you? Yeah. Go on like that. Or goes on like here, a person made two cakes and called up this woman, says, or two lemon pies, said, I just made two lemon pies. Would it be convenient for me to bring them over now? Or you want me to do it tomorrow? I want to do you a favor, see? One called up and said, on Monday I'm sending my personal secretary over to help you take care of your mail. And so you can get ready whatever you want to do. Jane Huff, who in her book, Whom the Lord Loveth, said that after a long illness of hers, she knew exactly what to do for people in need. A friend asked her what was the first thing, what the first thing would be, like for a sick person. What do you do? Jane says, the dishes. And it goes on and says, that really is right. Now, don't force yourself on that. You can't make up a rule or a law and say, force yourself and say, I'm going to come over and I'm going to do certain things. It reminds me of Doris Powell. She's asked me about three or four times in the seal. Can we come over and clean up the house? And I say, not yet. See, not yet. And they say, what are you going to do? Wait around until we get ready to come over, and then you'll get in and clean it all up. See, because you don't want us to see how dirty it is. And when can we come over? Now, I know they're sincere, and I know, and that is not the kind of thing that I'm talking about, where you come back and you ask three or four times, can I come out and clean up your house? Can I do this? Well, no, not yet. It really doesn't need it. Now, I told them the truth. It really didn't need it. It honestly didn't need it. And I can tell you right now, I intended to have you to come out until Ken came over, and I hope things change now around there. She's been vacuuming the floor. I did it once in the 3 months that I was there. But it'll change. But I did intend to call these ladies because they made me feel welcome. Do you see what I'm getting at? In other words, they didn't just say, if there's anything we can help you around the house with, why, give us a call. So I call them up someday. Hey, could you y'all come over and work about eight hours over here, you see, and doing this or that? You don't do it. Here's another one that says, things that break me up. A woman here writes this. Said, things that break me up. A room full of couples and me the only single woman. Saturday nights. And Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, and Friday. Coming home from work. I mean, I hope you see the little irony she got in there, but it's the truth. You see what she's really saying. Coming home from work. Going to work. Seeing an older couple walking hand in hand. Seeing a happily married older couple. Getting an unexpected sympathetic letter. Revisiting our places alone. Being with friends I met through Sam. Having to figure out alone what to do about the leaking gutters or the car. Looking north from my office toward the professional building where he worked. 11:45 at the office and no phone call. 7:15 in the morning and no phone ringing. 7:30 at night and no one at the door. A light blue car. Hints of springtime. Vacation plans. Just typing a list. Summer wind. Witchcraft. Frank Sinatra's record. Walking within a block of his office. Especially articles on how to achieve a happy marriage. These are things you have to deal with. And because they all do have an impact on you. Now, I don't read articles on happy marriages. All of a sudden, they turn sour to me. And when you see how to have a happy marriage, I flip the page immediately in the papers on this. Because the pain is just too much. Said, I wish there could be a yardstick to tell people when they've reached a point to start applying a little willpower. Now, there is a time that don't urge people to apply willpower. There is a time to urge them to apply, to try to do something. Said, when do you do this? When do you stop crying and try to put forth an effort? He said, I have no idea what is normal. I know I made a lot of people impatient with my drizzles and sniffles, which is why I stopped seeing them. Certainly, once the first year, with its various painful anniversaries, is over, you begin to see light. Yet it was a couple of months more than a year when the man who used to drive Dan brought me a box of candy on Dan's birthday, and I dissolved into tears instead of thanking him. Psychiatrists seem to think people should shape up faster than they usually do in normal grief. What is normal? Don't ask me. I'm going to see here if there's some other things here that I was wanting to try to get to. We have 5 minutes, and okay. Generally, by about 2 months after the husband's death, widows felt themselves to have recovered more than they would earlier have guessed possible, and began to see themselves again as able to deal with the responsibilities of their lives. 61% agreed at this point that, "I'm beginning to feel like myself again." Now, if you remember that magic 8 weeks I was talking about, that same feeling began to hit me. I'm feeling like it, but you're certainly not over it then. By the end of the first year of bereavement, most widows no longer made decisions primarily on the basis of their husband's wishes. You'd be surprised how long this happens. My mom has been a widow for 32 years, and she still does things that Brian would want done. And she's lived with him like this and held him in her heart for all this period of time. That's abnormal for her to do that. It's not caused her to be an abnormal woman, hasn't caused her to have psychic problems of any kind. But she was totally devoted to him. She's never thought of another man, and that's just the way that she's felt about him. But what you do is, and what I've done, is that I do certain things because I know that's the way Doris would want it. It's hard to break. We got some towels out there that has Hoodal on them. And I've tried to help her fold towels before, and I don't know how they made these towels. But anyway, I pick them up and fold them, that Hoodal goes in the middle as you fold it. It will not go on the outside. Unless you pick them up, and then you do it, and then you lay it down, you grab the other end somehow or another, and then you fold them. Only like a woman can do, I guess. So I'd get frustrated, and when I'd help her fold towels, I'd try to hide them. I'd fold a Hoodal in there, and she'd catch me every time. "Honey, here's the way you do it." And so we always had the Hoodals out. The Hoodals being out means a lot to her. Do you know I'm still folding those dumb things with the Hoodals out? And I folded a few with the Hoodals in. And it's hard. It's really hard, you know, just like last week and did the wash and got them out there. They're stupid Hoodal towels. And I tell you what I did. I took all the Hoodal towels and put them in Ken's closet. And all the other old rags. See, those are nice towels. And all the old rags in mine in there, so I don't have to fool with those Hoodals. But Kim somehow or another in washing put two or three of those Hoodals back in mine somewhere, and so I had to fold them. And so I thought, well, I'm going to fold those Hoodals any way I want. You just well put them out, you know. And it's hard. It's really hard. Sounds silly, but it's hard. That's what you're saying here. Now, I'm going to work with those Hoodals until I fold them any way I want. And when I get up there, I'm going to tell her, "Honey, I won the Hoodal battle." She'll know what I mean. After a year, widows were well on their way to having detached themselves from their husbands and their marriage, though the detachment might never be entirely complete. Typically what seemed to happen to couples and so forth, I'm not going to read this, but it's getting back down to where they experience the fifth wheel syndrome, that everywhere you are, and when this happens, there's always three people or five people or seven people, and we don't count like that. You know, we count 2, 4, 6, 8. That's how we count. And you go into a restaurant, and it's set up for 2, 4, 6, 8. But all of a sudden, it's either 3, 5, 7, 9 or something of this nature. And you notice it. I think that it'd be harder on a widow than it would be on a man. I notice it. It's hard on me. But not to the point, it's not one of the major problems, is what I'm getting at. I've kind of taken the attitude, I'm just a problem and you're going to have to put up with it. So put out one chair or take another chair away. On the widows, it says men have it better, and I believe they do. And we talk about women. I'll tell you that I think men have it much better than women. men have it better. More than 70% of men over 65 are married, compared to 30% of the women. You know that 70% of women over 65 are single? And so that's a pretty rough period of time. Okay, right there's where I'm going to quit. We're getting down now, and so next week we will start in the physical effects of bereavement, and I'll be able to finish up the books this next week on what we're going to be dealing with, and then we'll get into some other things. But what I was wanting to do here tonight in reading all of this is just to kind of go through what I've done is reading, man, I don't know how many books. Rod, how many have you brought me? Stacks. About 30 stacks of them, and checked out the books down at the library down here and bought all the books that I can find on the thing, so I have no idea how many I've read. That's the reason I was asking you. Somebody asked me the other day, and I don't have any idea. And what I've done is just to take the major parts out of them, and really, I don't think I've read anything in here that I haven't told you before, you know, in my experience. But one thing that it does is that you can say, well, Lowell, you know, you took it too hard. You were a baby about it. You took it too easy. You're coming out of it too fast. You could say, you're just one guy, and this is the first time you've been through it, and you don't understand, and all those things. They're all legitimate. That's the reason I was wanting to read these things, coming out of book after book after book after book, is just to show you that, no, everybody's alike, and what I've told you, the statistics really bear up.